afternoon. So, last time we went through how condition codes actually work with the different condition codes that XD6 has chosen to use, so the zero flag, sign flag, overflow flag, and carry flag, that lets all our various conditional jump instructions that do signed or unsigned comparisons apparently work. We also talked about ways of compiling various types of C code into assembly, including strategies for switch statements, where we had this jump table with this computed jump instruction that reads a value from memory, what the next instruction to run is. And then we talked about more general issues with instruction sets. So we talked about the difference between microarchitecture, the design of the hardware, and the design of the instruction set and machine code that that hardware uses. And they're related, but that these are different things. And about choices that are made in instruction set design, and particularly looking at this classic sort of two philosophies of the CISC machines, providing useful instructions for assembly writers, and this RISC philosophy of making it simpler for the hardware, and therefore hopefully more efficient, because presumably compilers can deal with the extra difficulty of producing assembly with these simpler instruction sets. And then we looked at YID6, which is our subset of XD6 we'll be using for a lot of the rest of the course. And we looked at things that were either different from XD6 or that we hadn't seen in XD6. And one thing we hadn't seen in XD6 was conditional moves, which is basically a jump to skip over a move and a move in one instruction. So we had a conditional move greater than is if greater than, do the move, otherwise skip over it. And we also talked about moves in general, how one of the choices we made in this instruction set was to split up moves into four instructions based on the types of the operands. And I'll justify why did we bother with that renaming later. What property we're getting by doing this. So any questions on anything we covered last time? Okay. So some logistical issues. So there is a post quiz for this week and a pre-quiz for next week, because I believe that you should all be able to obtain a textbook. So, expect that. The quiz is on the reading for next week, which is on the schedule. It's also on the quiz page. It says, with the quiz, what you need to read, what we, might have on the quiz. And obviously, I'm not going to ask you like a 20-question quiz, so yeah, there might be some sections which don't have any questions. Also, the bomb homework. Grades, assuming you've finished it and are taking advantage of the late policy, are in the gradebook. Please check. Sometimes people don't actually register the BOM to their computing ID for various reasons. And if this happened to you, we can fix it, but we need to know that there's a problem. Also, if you checked the gradebook earlier, there might have been some weird comments if you had used multiple BOMs, like a different one for the lab and the homework. That should be fixed now. It should all be what the grade is expected to be, and the comments shouldn't suggest you did anything you didn't do, or didn't do anything you did do. And we also have lab next week. So I mentioned earlier that the lab next week is this in-lab quiz, so you'll be in front of a lab machine without access to notes or anything like that, writing two functions. These are the two functions. So one is string length, finds the length of a null terminated string. So null meaning the null character, that's zero, byte. And string set is a function which divides a string into tokens. So the lab has a full description of string set, but it's in a very sort of function specification, so you know exactly what the right thing is. I'm going to give you sort of an intuition today about what it's supposed to do, hopefully help you understand what the task is. So the idea of string set is that we can take a string like this sentence here, this is a test, and divide it into tokens, in this case words. So split it up by spaces and iterate through each word in the string. And the way it's going to work is that we're going to pass a pointer to a pointer, which is going to keep track of where we are in the string. and this function's going to return various parts of the string. So, for example, the first time we call it, it's going to return the word this. And the way it's going to do that is that it's going to insert a null character in place of the first space, and then it's going to return a pointer to the first T. And by doing that, this is a separate string because of how strings in C work. And it's also going to need to update the pointer it returns to point to the place it needs to start next. So it's going to update that pointer to point to the beginning of is. So it knows next time it needs to start at is and return something from that part of the original input string. And the idea is that you can use it something like this and divide up a string into pieces. So that's the function you're implementing and sort of its intended use case. So the lab has the precise specification, including all of the corner cases. Because this is confusing, I want to give an intuition for what this function is for. So any questions on either of the functions for the lab? Or anything about the lab next week?
Yeah. I don't understand what the second pointer does. So there are two pointers.
So it's the type of the first argument is pointer to pointer. So it originally is going to point to, it's a pointer to the string, and later on it points to the current location we're at in the string. And the function needs to update it to do that. That's why it's a pointer to pointer, so we can update PTR, not update and have the modifications persist between calls to the function. Yes?
So are we modifying the same string that's being inputted, or are we modifying a copy?
So the question is, are we modifying the string that's inputted or a copy? There is no copy made. We are modifying the original. If you use this function and you want to preserve the original string, you are responsible for making a copy. Yes?
Computer?
You're doing this on computer. It will be a full screen coding environment. It is web browser based, so you can try it out on your own outside of the lab, and it will be exactly the thing you will use in lab. Yeah?
How do you get the environment?
It is linked for taking the in lab quiz.
Yeah.
It is linked from the lab right up. Yes, so you could access to it now, but nothing you do outside of lab will count. You will only count what you do in lab time. But you are free to use it as much as you like outside of lab, and we just will ignore those submissions when determining your grade. Okay, so back to what we were talking about last time, which was the Y86 instruction set. So we went over our various change instructions. We had our kind of new C-move conditional move instructions. We had the various renamed move instructions and halt because we needed a way to stop the machine. And we mentioned about how our memory access instructions work. So one thing is that This is our register to memory move. That's what the R and M stand for. And this is the way we specify addresses and not anything else. And this is just a choice we've made to keep things simpler for us to implement. Yes?
Just to be clear, the thing on this slide is the answer to the quiz, right? Like that's a solution to the function.
The quiz? Sorry.
The quiz in lab next week is to write that.
The quiz in lab magnet used to write that function, yes. So, this is a question about string set. So, this is an example of how that function is used. There's not actually an implementation on the slide. However, there is an actual correct answer in the lab write-up. You just aren't allowed to look at it while you're doing it. Yes?
You can look at it before.
Yes.
Okay.
You can look at it before and you can memorize it. This is not actually a great strategy because if you make a typo from what you memorized, you need to be able to figure out what's wrong. And we've had people who've not done well on this because that was their strategy. It was just to rote memorize it, not have any idea what the code does, and then they forget a star to dereference a pointer somewhere and suddenly nothing works. And they have no idea how to fix it. Okay, so this is how we're going to specify addresses in YA664. This offset and base register, it's the only thing we support. All the other options, we're just not going to do. Easier job for us. Also, let's say we have, add instruction. In XD6, you're used to specifying a memory address somewhere in there. This is going to be just disallowed. We're just not going to have that instruction. The only thing you can add is two registers. So if I have this code, what do I do to fix that? If I'm telling you to write YAD6 and you won't, and I give you this code, how do you make it into YAD6 assembly? The one solution. Yeah?
Break it up into four instructions, so you would add 10 to R11 and then you would add R11
to R12. So break it up into two instructions. So you said to add 10 to R11 and then R11 to R12. So what is this? So this instruction, as shown in here, reads memory from 10 plus R11 and adds it to R12. So there's a little extra in there. But yes, the idea is you break this up into two steps. So our first step is going to be a read the value from memory, which is going to do the addition internally. But we do have one instruction to do that, which is the instruction I showed on the previous slide. Well, the opposite of this, the MR version. But we know that that's the syntax we're going to use for memory accesses. So we do a memory to register move, and then we do the addition. And the problem here is that to do this, I wrote a value to a register that we didn't do in the XD6 version. So we needed a spare register. Which is going to be a common theme today. Okay. So this makes sense. It's translation, what we actually going to have to do in YD6. So also, we can't do this, for example, for two reasons. One, that's not a form of memory access we support, and two, we don't allow you to do memory accesses in the middle of an add. So how would you rewrite this as YAD6 assembly? Try to write down an answer and then review. Okay, so someone will think they have an answer.
So after changing the address to R11, it was 10 by 10, you also access the memory in R11 and loaded into R11.
So after doing what to the R11?
After setting the offset, like we're just did by MR moving
okay.
R11, 10 R11 to R11, we access the memory in R11, set the pointer to that memory, and then add that.
Okay, so we have this problem here, which is that the original doesn't multiply as R11 times 8. I'm not sure where you were doing that. But, yeah, so that's the tricky step, unfortunately. Yes?
When you are moving, from the memory into a register, do you have to break up multiplication and addition?
So do we have to do separate steps? So the question is, when we're moving memory into a register, do we have to break up multiplication and addition? You mean for the address computation?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. So this is the only type of computation we can do. So we can do additions when we make an address. But that's the only thing that's supported. So everything else has to be some sort of separate step, which is the right idea. That, yeah, whole thing here is that we need some separate step to compute this address. Yeah.
So we don't have IMAP on YAD6, right?
So yes. So the obvious thing, the first solution most people think of is do a multiply instruction. And then you look at this and there's no multiply instruction. Another thing people might think of is do an LEA. There's no LEA. Yeah. Yeah, so the easiest, as far as I know, the shortest solution is to add it to itself three times. There are other things you could do. You could also use another register, set it to zero, add eight times. That's fine. But I think the shortest solution I know of is to add it to itself three times, then do a memory read, then do an add. So this one x86 instruction turns into five y86 instructions. Yes?
Can you explain why you add it times?
So each time we're doubling it. So we're doubling it three times. That's the same as multiplying times eight. So this is the shortest solution I know of. There's others, but we have to do something like this to do the same thing in y86. Because we're missing instructions, and we're also missing ways of specifying operands and instructions. So this is pretty inconvenient if you're writing assembly, but pretty fortunate if you're building hardware simulators, because it means you don't need to make that instruction work that we started with. You can just make these simpler ones work, which will be a lot less work. Okay, so that's about accessing memory and what you're going to do, since you can't do it in all the places you're used to doing in x86. Another thing is about constants. So IRMoveQ takes a constant, which is not an address, which is just a constant integer. It is the only y86 instruction which does that. Cannot use a constant integer value anywhere else and have it be interpreted as an integer. There are places where we have constant addresses, but those are addresses. So in particular, this means we can't do our usual add one to something. So what do we need to do instead? Well, how can we deal with this not being a valid y86 instruction, or writing y86 assembly? Yeah. Yeah, so we need an extra register, and the easiest thing to do is to move one into that register and add it. And that's sort of the simplest solution. Which is awfully inconvenient, because more so than the sort of add with a fancy memory address I showed you before, this is very common in assembly you might want to write, but you're gonna need to do it in this sort of way, and also have a spare register that you don't need lying around. So what's the advantage of having all these restrictions? So, you know, and why do we choose this particular set of rules about things we don't allow as operands? So there is a logic behind it, which will help you remember what the rules are and also make sense when we're implementing hardware. And that's that there's only one kind of value for each operand of an instruction. So for each instruction, there's only one kind of value you can have for the source and destination. There's no other choices. IRMoveQ is always a constant and a register. There's nothing else that's allowed. And this is why we split the move up instruction into separate instructions, is to preserve this property. But for all our other instructions, there's only one possibility. We can add a register and a register and nothing else. So this is convenient for our hardware because it means we don't have to worry about which version of the operands do we have. Once we know what the instruction is, we're going to know exactly what type of operands to expect, which is simpler than what x86 processors have to do, where they have to do a bunch of work after they know what the instruction is to figure out what format are the operands in and how do I deal with that. So any questions on this rule? Okay, so that simple rule. So other things in y86. So y86, as I mentioned earlier, has condition codes. We'll only be using ZF and SF. Our book uses OF, and not CF, but uses OF, we just won't. Just to keep things simpler, but this means that we're producing the wrong answer for some comparisons. These are set by add, subtract, and an XOR, and that is the complete list of instructions that set the condition codes. There's no other instruction in Y86 which is going to do that. And this is just an arbitrary choice, but we'll keep things simpler. So when we use these condition codes, just like in X86, they're named after thinking about the results of subtraction. So the zero flag for subtraction indicates the operands were equal. So our equal case is the zero flag is 1. Our not equal case is the zero flag is 0. Negative indicates that the thing we subtracted from was smaller than the other thing. So that indicates less than. So the sign flag, which indicates whether it's negative, it corresponds to less. And we can figure out what we're supposed to do for every single type of jump or conditional move based on that. And these rules would be a little more complicated if we have the overflow flag involved, which is a table in your textbook. Okay. You may notice one omission that we had on that list of instructions in Y86 was compare and test. So these instructions would not be hard to implement, but we just don't have them. So what can we do given that we don't have them if we want to do comparisons? Just do a normal subtraction, and sorry, you just wrote over a register. So whenever you want to do a comparison, you want to write a comp queue, you write a subtract, and just make sure that you aren't using the destination register for anything important if you don't actually care about the result of the subtraction. And ideally you would, say, that's a space, but you might not. But that's our only option, keeps things simpler. Wouldn't actually be hard to implement in hardware the compare instruction because, as I said, it's exactly the same as the subtract instruction, except we just forget to write a register, the destination register. So we have four more instructions left, I think, which are considerably more complicated. These are the most complicated instructions in YD6. So two of them are push and pop. So push decrements the stack pointer, then stores a value where the stack pointer would now point. And pop reads a value based on the stack pointer and increments it. So this is the order these things happen in. The way I remember this is that the stack pointer points to something that's actually on the stack. For tests, we're not going to have you memorize this. We will tell you at the beginning of the test this rule because this is a stupid reason to get test questions wrong. But this is how that works, and these are the most complicated instructions because they're basically doing two things. They're both, incrementing a value and reading or writing to memory. And very similar are the call and return instructions. So the call instruction looks very much like push, except instead of pushing the value stored in a register, it pushes what we'll call the program counter, the address of the next instruction to run onto the stack. And then it jumps to the label specified. So it's kind of a combination of a push, not of a register, but of the next instruction address and a jump. The return pops an address from the stack, but instead of storing it in a normal register, it stores it in where we're keeping track of the next instruction to run. Otherwise, it's very much like a pop. So any questions on how call and return or push and pop are supposed to work? Yeah. Where does call jump to? Call jumps to the address specified by the label in the instruction. So you can think of it as push next instruction address followed by jump label. If you have call label in your assembly, that's basically what it does. Yes?
Is it pushed to a special register or is it to the return register?
Does return?
When you said push and then jump, it's pushing an instruction.
It's pushing the address of the next instruction, which will, you know, isn't in any particular register that we know of, certainly. We'll talk about how we'll implement that in hardware. But it's kind of like if you specify that, you know, it's equivalent to if you could write that somehow. So those are all our instructions. And so to look at this systematically, we'll talk about state in YAD6. So state is the things we need to know what the processor is going to do next. And this is all the information we could possibly need to figure out what the processor will do. This is the complete information. So we have our registers, and we're going to have 15 registers. And if you know x86-64, this seems a little low, and it is. So we've eliminated R15. I'll talk later about why the textbook authors chose to do that. We also do not have the smaller parts of registers, like EAX, AX, those things that we had in x86. We've just gotten rid of them. Everything, all registers that we can specify in assembly are 64 bits all the time, no exceptions. It's not hard to implement 32-bit versions of all the operators, but wouldn't be worth your time if you already have a 64-bit one. We also have our condition code. So that's going to be something we're storing in our processor, even though it's not a named register. So we have ZF and SF need to be stored. And we have this thing that our book will call stat, which is the processor status. We need to know whether the processor is supposed to keep going or not. So we have that halt instruction. We need to know, we need to store somewhere the information to not keep going. So that's going to be in that stat register. And we also have the program counter, sometimes called an instruction pointer, which is the address of the next instruction to run or the instruction we're running. It's the address of the instruction we're currently on that we care about right now. And then we have finally the big thing, memory. So if you know the values of all these, you know exactly what the processor is supposed to do next and forever onwards. This is everything the processor works with. So any questions about any of the things here? Okay. So that's everything about YAD6 as far as the assembly. And we can go back and think about, when I talk about this RISC philosophy, think about how well YAD6 adheres to that. So, and I've highlighted the RISC properties I think are definitely satisfied by our textbook author's choice. And I've crossed out one which definitely is not, and the ones in black are debatable. So we have fewer, simpler instructions. So we definitely have fewer instructions than, you know, the things we're comparing to, and even compared to many RISC instruction sets. But they're not necessarily simpler. So push, pop, call, and return are actually pretty complicated. They basically do two things or three things, you know, as you might think about them, and they're more complicated than the sorts of instructions you'd ever see in a RISC processor. We do have, however, separate instructions to access memory. So we never have an instruction where we get something from memory and then do computation on it. It's always, that computation always needs to be a separate instruction after the memory access. And this simplifies our hard work. That's a very RISC-like choice to make. So as we're going to show next, we don't have fixed length instructions. The machine code that our textbook authors have chosen has variable length instructions to save space. But that means that the hardware is going to be a bit more complicated to deal with that. We have more registers than is typical of the real diehard CISC instruction set. So I have this not sort of in red because, well, 15 isn't that many, and it's less than x86. But the classic sort of CISC architectures have this idea that you just be accessing values in memory all the time. which clearly we're not doing, and we have enough registers around to make it convenient to write assembly where you usually work on values and registers. And things that are usually considered risk, usual numbers of registers are 16 or 32, somewhere around that range. And we certainly have avoided really complicated instructions. We have no instructions that effectively do a loop. Nothing like that. They're all, you know, clearly a bounded amount of computation, basically a fixed amount. And we have no instructions which need to access memory multiple times to get their data or to read data and write data. And we also have few addressing modes. We have a minimal number of ways of specifying operands. We have a way of specifying a memory operand, addresses that are constant labels to jump to, constants, and registers. So we have four types of operands, that's it. If you look at x86 with all the ways of specifying memory operands and things like that, you're up to like, you know, 16 or something like that. Maybe probably more. So we're kind of risk-like, and we'll see that this will give us advantages when we talk about doing a hardware implementation. So any questions about any of these sort of risk concepts and how they apply to YD6 or work in general? Okay, so if not, we'll go on to looking at our non-fixed length instructions. What is our instruction encoding like? So here is a table showing the instruction encoding. So instructions are multiple bytes, and I'm showing in different parts of each byte. So there's 4-bit fields in many of these instructions. So for example, for the halt instruction, there's a 0 as the top 4 bits of the first byte, and a 0 as the bottom 4 bits of the first byte. For the nop instruction, there's a 1 as the top 4 bits of the first byte, and a 0 as the bottom. So this means that the first byte of the nop instruction is going to be, and the only byte is going to be hex 10 in memory. And some of these fields are going to represent things which are left specified in the instruction that vary between different versions of the instruction. So for example, we have registers, and those appear in our second byte of the instructions which need registers. And we have some 4 bits which represents one of the registers and another 4 bits which represents the other if there is one. And sometimes we have constant values, and those are going to be 8 bytes, always 8 bytes, and always in little endian, because that's what x86 uses. So the first thing you might notice, the most important thing at least, is the thing in blue. So each of these instructions, no matter what the fields are, in the exact same place has this blue field, which our book calls the I code. They might call it the opcode, the primary opcode. And it says what kind of instruction it is. So if we look at that blue field, we know exactly for what fields we need to look at in the instruction and how long it is. This is going to make our hardware more convenient. There are instruction sets where you can't just look one place to figure out what's in the instruction. But for ours, that's what we're going to do. So when you're looking at machine code for a YD6 instruction, that's the first place you look, because it tells you where everything else is. And this is a point where it's convenient that we have different instructions for different types of operands, because that property is what makes this work out so well. So some of these instructions have this purple field, which I've either marked as CC for condition code or FN for function code. And this is kind of a secondary opcode. So we have these groups of similar instructions which share a primary opcode, the thing in blue, or our book calls the I code, but have this secondary opcode because some little part of the instruction is different. And in hardware, we're mostly going to do the same things on these instructions, not of the type, but there's one step where we need to do something different depending on which variation it is. So one example is conditional moves. So for conditional moves, we have less than, less. We do basically the same thing except for that one step where we test the condition. We also have another simplification, which is that RR move queue is just a conditional move where the condition is always true. And so to simplify things, we just encode it like a conditional move, but we have a number to represent a condition that's always true. So it's conditional move always. And that's sort of the machine code encoding. And we do the same thing for conditional jumps. An unconditional jump, but just a normal jump instruction, is a jump always. So we just encode this condition meaning always instead of less than. But that's why we share the opcode for those things. This is going to be simpler in the hardware. We don't need to recognize two different opcodes. Also, saves us opcodes, so we could expand this instruction set later more easily. So the second type of secondary opcode we have is on this thing labeled opcue. So this is one opcode for all the arithmetic instructions. And we share one opcode because most of the work we do on arithmetic instructions is the same. We need to read two values from registers, set condition codes, and write a value to a register. So except for that, which actual operation we do, which is a surprisingly small amount of the work, it's all the same, so it's helpful to have them all have the same opcode. And so we have this secondary opcode, this function code, which says whether we're doing an add, a subtract, an AND, or an XOR. Okay. So that's the first byte, which is where we find out what the operation is. I mentioned that our second byte is where we store register information for those instructions which care about the register. And we have just a mapping from our register names to numbers, from 0 to 14. You don't have to memorize this, because that would be silly, but there's this mapping you've chosen. And every time we need to know what the register specifying the instruction is, we look up in the appropriate part of the machine code, and you can use this table to find out which number is which register. You may notice that we have space for register 15, but we're not using it. So we'll have a reason in hardware where that will make sense. There's something that will be more convenient about our hardware implementation because we've done that. That's why our textbook authors chose to do it. But our machine code clearly has room for a 15th register. So another thing you may notice is that we have these 8-byte fields. As I said, these are little endian, which gets people. So these are 8-byte little endian numbers. And for these instructions, so for IR move queue, it's the constant. For the RM move queue and MR move queue, this is the displacement, the thing we're adding to the base register to form the address. It's always stored in this location of the instruction. We also have fields representing addresses. So for jumps and call, we need to represent the label. And the way we're going to represent that is with the address written out as 8 bytes in little endian order of the machine code that we would jump to if we run one of these instructions. Yes?
Sorry, what's the V and V again?
So the V is the value, the immediate value in the IR move queue. And the D is the displacement. The main thing that matters is that it corresponds to the right thing in the assembly snippet on the left side. So that's everything in the encoding. So this table shows you how to encode instructions. So let's go from start to finish. So let's say I have this function, and I want to convert it to YD6 machine code. So maybe I'll first start with my x86 version. So that x86 version is not correct YD6, so how do I fix that first? It's just raining down. What should that look like as YD6 code? So write down what you think it is first. You write down an answer so you can read it off. Okay, can someone just read me the instructions that would do this? Yeah. No? No volunteers? Okay. Yeah, sure.
R move Q, present RDI, present RX, and then IR move Q, assign 1, and then present R12, and then add Q, present R12, and present RX.
Okay. So that's one solution, is to allocate another register, like R12, to 1, and move it there. So I'm going to use a slightly shorter solution just to save space in my slides, which is maybe a little clever, maybe not, of moving 1 into REX and then adding with the destination of REX, just to save space in my slide. But both are valid ways of translating it to something that's valid in Y86, but you just needed to get rid of the move queue, needs to turn into something else, because we don't have plain move queue, and the add can't take a constant. Yeah?
So I was going to ask about the pop RX beforehand, but I guess that's just where you're
the pop?
RX.
So do we need to save the old value of REX is the question? Yeah, so the answer is no, because that's where our return value goes, so our caller better not depend on anything about REX. Yeah?
Sorry, this was a thing I was thinking about. Why do the two registers used for like memory and register memory?
So the question is, MR move Q and RM move Q, they only, why do they have two registers in the encoding? And that's because we have RB here, the base register, and RA, the source register for RM move Q, and also a base and a destination register for MR move Q. And those both need to appear in the machine code somewhere.
But isn't it going to the, like, is that way the 8 bytes for D?
The 8 bytes is for the thing we add to the base register.
So it's all based on a register implementation?
Yeah, so it's a base register plus that displacement. So we could have just had a register be the address. That would be a reasonable choice. But you know, this makes it slightly convenient for assembly programmers to give this extra field. Yeah.
So you make moving from register to register or normal on comp to a register optional by having double variables in the second register and just making those break the variable for the constant.
So make moving from, sorry, I didn't get. Yeah.
Sometimes you can move constantly into registers. So the second register, I'm assuming, if it's not a register, it's constant, has like a dummy variable, like a non-register.
So the question is, how do we move constants into registers? Or
how does it determine whether or not to move a constant into a register?
So the question is, how do we move non-move constants into register? That's because we have IR move Q here. It's a separate instruction, and we notice that we're missing one of the register fields. We just have a constant value in its place, because we don't take that register field. So the way we know that is by the opcode. We could have chosen some other signal where we had one move in opcode and something else which tells us what registers matter, but we didn't. And also we have no way of just moving a constant memory location, loading from there into a register. We need to have a base register. It's not optional. Okay. So we get this. So this is the translation, going back to this example. People are thinking about where to put registers. So my procedure for converting this into machine code is, once I have the actual assembly, I can just go through it instruction by instruction and just basically copy an entry from the table. So I look at the line in the table corresponding to IR move Q, and I write out what's on that line. I have 30F, and then I have something representing register B, which is RAX. I'll just have that as a dotted line for now. And then I have the constant that I'm moving, which I'm going to represent in little endian. So this is the list of little bytes in little endian. So the first byte is 1, the remaining bytes are zeros. And I have this placeholder here where I wrote RAX, so I just need to look up in that table I showed you earlier what the number corresponding to RAX is. If I do that, I find out it's 0. It's completely mechanical. And I can go on and do this process for each instruction in our assembly. So for the add instruction, that's one of the op cues. So I know I have 6, I have something representing a function. We know the one, we want whatever the number for add is. And then I have the 2 registers, I want whatever the number for RDI is, and whatever the number for RAX is. So I just look those up in the tables I showed you earlier. You know, and I happen to get these values, and that should be a relatively mechanical process. And I can do that again. So I take RET, which is the easiest instruction in this snippet. It's just 9-0, there's nothing to fill in, no thinking, that's what it is. So I have these translations based on that table, and now I need to turn this into a list of bytes. So I just read out these bytes one by one. I say 3-0, that's the first byte. F-0, that's the second byte, and this is in hexadecimal. What, how the table works, and then I have 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, and so on. Then 6, 0, 7, 0, just reading out what I got translated and looked up in the table. So any questions about any of the steps here? This is something you could, yeah.
What's F again?
F is the constant 15 as a hex digit.
Why?
So the question is, why did we choose to put, we have a bunch of constants here, actually. We have zeros, we have Fs, and Fs here. Why did we choose to do that? Why do I insist on having a particular value there? So general good practice when making instruction sets is to not let people make choices that shouldn't matter, like what to put in bytes you aren't using, so you have flexibility for the future. As for why F, there will be something in our hardware implementation that will make a little bit easier. Okay, So any questions about this translation process? Everyone feel like they could do this on a test, given the tables that I showed you earlier? Not gonna have you memorize any of those tables. That's not kind. Okay. And so final note, so here's another example. So I have a double function here. So I have and a label. Let's say I know the address of that label, so this add queue here. Same process as before, fill in the blanks, I have a blank for add, a blank for each of the registers, figure out what those are. Then I have this jump greater than equal. So we have 2 blanks there, one for the condition code, so we need to look up what greater than equal is. We also need to fill in the address. And if I happen to know that that label ends up being an address, hex 123, I know how to write that out as machine code. So I write out 7 for the opcode, 5 to represent the greater than equal, and then 2 3s, then 1, then all zeros to write that address in little endian. So this clear to everyone? Any questions? Okay. So that's the forward encoding process. Should be reasonably mechanical. And you know, you look at the table, you look things up, you get a list of 4-bit quantities, convert that to bytes, which are 2 4-bit things making up each byte, and that gives you the machine code. So how about the other direction? So here's a bunch of machine code, and you need to decode it. What's the first thing that you want to do? Yeah. Okay, so a good place to start is that we know I told you that this blue part, this primary opcode, is in the same place in all the instructions, in the first byte, and it tells you what other things are in the instruction and how long it is. So I can look at the primary opcode here. I have a 2. Which means that I know I'm in this row of the table. So what I like doing with this first, not the only choice. So one thing you could do is you could just start going through this table entry, say, oh, where's CC in there? What I like to do first is just look at the primary opcode, say, okay, this means it's 2 bytes, so the next primary opcode is here. I look up 6 in the table, it's this one. Oh, that's 2 bytes, so the next one is here, and I can keep going and find all the primary opcodes and where all the instructions start. That's what I prefer to do when doing this mechanically. You can also do it step by step. Just do the whole instruction at once. So once you've figured out where each instruction starts, then it's a process of matching it to the table. So you just look at the table and say, okay, what things are the fill in the blanks in the table, and what are they filled in with? And just use those tables not to look up REX, but to what REX's number is, but to look up a number and find out the register, for example. So in the first case, our blanks are, we have the condition code as the first blank, and that's 0. And if you look that up in the table I showed you earlier, that's for always. So that tells us it's not a conditional move, it's an RR move queue. Then we look up what register 1 represents, and that's RCX in the table I showed you earlier. We can look up what register 0 represents, and that's REX in the table I showed you earlier. That gives us the instruction. And we repeat this process for the later instructions. So for example, on the 6-0, 6 is up queue, so I have a function code to look up. First one's add, second one's subtract, and I have 2 register numbers to look up in the same way. And we can keep doing this. Get a jump instruction. When I write out jump instructions, I translate directly from machine code. I usually just write them with an address instead of a label, but you can do either. And we eventually figure out what this whole assembly, machine code is as equivalent assembly. So any questions about any step of this process? Everyone feel like you can do this by hand? Yes?
How do you differentiate instructions and like non-instructions?
So the question is, how do we differentiate between instructions and and data?
Yeah.
So you can't really. Hopefully you can figure out by reading the instructions where it is possible to go to or not. But unless you actually know what gets executed, you don't know whether some set of numbers is reachable as an instruction or not. And it is possible to read from memory where instructions are. That is completely legal. Just because an address stores instructions doesn't mean you can't read from it. So it can be used as data and instructions. So it's just a matter of what will the processor actually do. Will it try to execute this as an instruction or not? Typically, when we give you machine code snippets, we will not do tricks like have non-instructions in the middle.
Okay.
But at least when we're telling you to do this task, we might have non-instructions in the middle, but ask you like what the result is or something like that, where you can figure out, oh, that's not an instruction. Yes?
Is there an RR move
queue missing? That is quite possible. That is, in fact, probable. So yeah, there probably should be some sort of RR move queue here or here, showing that no one in the last class did this out. Okay. But the point I want to get across is the decoding procedure, which some people seem to be able to do. So that's sort of everything you should need to know about YD6 encoding. And I'd like to comment about why does it look like this? So we have some properties here which our textbook authors chose because they're convenient for making implementations. So we have 4 bits to figure out the exact layout. That's really convenient for implementations. Not all instruction sets do that, but that's sort of a deliberately chosen property. It's why we have that opcode like we do. That's why we chose sort of our operand layouts like we did. We have mostly uniform placement of operands. So this is why we have wasted space. So for example, we're wasting a whole byte in every IRMoveQ instruction. We have a constant 0 and a constant f. We're not using that. We could just get rid of the byte, make it simpler. But the advantage we get by not doing that is that all our register numbers are in the same part of the instruction. So this means our hardware that implements this is much simpler. That when we want to find start access registers, we just look always in the exact same place and get the register. This also kind of explains why we chose F here, because that's not a valid register number. And another example is in push. Push and pop, for example. We could have saved a byte, but we don't. Just to make things simpler. Another nice property is that we've chosen halt to be the instruction with opcode 0. And that has the nice property that if we end up jumping to uninitialized space that's probably zeros, we probably halt instead of doing something more confusing. So that's probably why halt is the 0 instruction and not something else. And we never attempt to fit instructions in less than whole byte segments. So every instruction, even ones where it seems like we don't have a whole byte of information, like return, we use a whole byte for. This means we never have to worry about decoding instructions that are partly in one byte and with another instruction. So that makes our hardware simpler, even though it might not be the most compact encoding we could have. And these sorts of decisions are very common in real instruction sets to make the hardware implementation easier, even though it might seem somewhat wasteful. Okay. So that's about YD6. So any questions about YD6 in general before we talk about a related topic? Okay, coding and decoding. So I'd like to look at, since we know about the YD6 encoding now, how I would write a C function to extract that I code, that blue part in our table, given I have a pointer to an instruction. So what would be a way of writing this? I'm going to come up with, I have a pointer to a byte that is one of these instructions, the first byte of it, and I want to extract that 4-bit field, which is the I code. So isn't it a byte error? So a byte is 8 bits.
Yeah.
Okay. So we want to get half of the byte.
Yeah.
So what would be a way of doing this in C? Yeah. So you're talking about shifting bytes, which is something we will get to. So there's something you definitely know how to do in C that will do this. And to think about it, one thing we can look at is that if we think about, so NOP, for example, NOP is 0x10, and the 1 is the thing we want to extract. And that's hexadecimal, the way it works. It's 1 times 16 to the first plus 0 times 16 to the 0th. So we can divide by 16. So that would be a way of doing it that you should all know about in C. And it happens that C division also rounds the correct way for integer division. It rounds towards 0. So that's going to actually give us the correct answer. So this is one way of extracting that. So we get the first byte with index 0 from the pointer, then we divide that by 16, and that gives us the iCode field, which is the upper 4 bits of that byte. Okay, and this makes sense? Yes? Yeah. So if we have something like NOP, we have this 1 here that is 1 times 16 plus 0 times 1. So whatever is in that top 4 bits is effective to form that hex number, we multiply it by 16. We're just undoing that and rounding down to get rid of the rest. And that's exactly what the C division operator, when dividing by 16, will do. Does this make sense? Any seem like a reasonable implementation? So there's an issue with doing the obvious thing to implement this in reality, and that's that division is really slow. I thought I corrected this for, that's the corrected slide, but for example, on the Skylake microarchitecture, which is like 3 years old, and it's typical of what modern things are, it takes about 6 cycles to divide, do a 1-byte division. In contrast, on the same processor, you could do 4 different 64-bit additions in a cycle. So division is 24 times slower than multiplication, than addition. So it's real slow. But we're doing something really simple here. And that is, if you think about how we would do this in hardware and why this was a reasonable instruction encoding, when we're not worried about our instructions taking 6 cycles to run, is because we can just take a bundle of wires that holds the top byte of the instruction and take off 4 of them, and that gives us the opcode. So it's really simple in hardware. Why can't we make it that way in software? And it turns out that we do expose a mechanism to do it, but it's not division. And this is the shifting alluded to earlier. So in x86, there's an instruction called shift right, which just moves the bits over. It's right because it means towards the lower significance. Endianness is not involved, it means just towards lower significance values. So it's like division. You can see that we take the 4 bytes that we are looking to extract, move them over to the part of the bottom of the number, which is exactly what division was doing. Now, unlike in our hardware, where we could take 8 wires and get 4 at the end, that's not really an option for this instruction. The register is going to be the same width before and after. It's not going to change. So we need to do something with the remaining bits of the register. And the choice that's made for this instruction, just arbitrarily, is to put in zeros. Because we have to put something there. Register has those bits. We need to use them. So this makes sense. And unlike division, this operation is pretty easy to implement in hardware and fast. You don't need to do any, because this is the simple case of division, basically. Yeah?
Could you divide something you can see by the power of 2 in integer division? Does C like optimize it that it's just bishop thing?
So the question is, well, can C compilers just do this for you? And the answer is, if it's dividing by a constant that's a power of 2, yes, they can and they will. They know that this is faster, a lot faster, and they will do it when they can figure out that you're dividing by a power of 2. So you, in fact, might get code like this generated for that function that I showed you earlier. Remove the value byte from memory and do a shift. However, in C, we also have the option of not just depending on our compiler knowing about this, but writing this explicitly. So there's a syntax for writing a right shift, which is something you maybe have seen before in a different context, that the operator you use for CN, it's actually the right shift operator. And it, you know, corresponds directly to that instruction. So yeah, and as I said, so compilers will figure this out when it's a constant, they'll do the translation for you. They might not always do the, doesn't mean they always generate exactly the same code, but for example, but they generally know about this rule. So the right shift operator, that the one we see in C, you can think of it either as sort of manipulating bits, like the straightforward hardware implementation, or you can just think about it as a specialized division operator. So it performs, you know, this division, x divided by 2 to the power of y, and then round down. And that's just true in general. So you can think about it either way, it's equivalent. That's what the hardware is implementing. Yeah.
How is it different than like SRA?
So the question is that there's something else called SRA. We will get to that on Tuesday. So there, it is different than SRA. And yeah, we'll talk about why. The short summary is we made an arbitrary choice earlier and you can make a different choice there. Any other questions about this? Okay. So you might say, so we saw the version of converting something with an opcode into just the iCode part, the primary opcode. We can also look at constructing that first byte, doing the opposite operation of multiplying times 16. And similarly to how we had a way of shifting values over. This is another case where, you know, multiply, it's not as bad as divide. It's not nearly as slow. But, you know, this is really much simpler than general multiplication in hardware. In hardware, we just take a bunch of wires with low voltage and put them next to it, and that's all the work we do. If you want to construct a opcode with a zero from that top 4 bits. And, you know, I might think, well, we can just shift with a negative number. You know, that would be a logical thing to implement. And it's not what, in fact, x86 has chosen to do or C has chosen to do. So instead, you have shift left, which does the opposite. So it moves things over to the left, that is towards more significant bits. And you put zeros in the bottom places. And you can write this in C with what you may know of as the cout operator. That's actually what it is. Yes?
So I think there's a bit in C++ to do shifting so that the bits that are off at the end are wrapped back around.
So is there a way to have the bits wrap around instead of filling in zeros, is what you're asking?
Well, I didn't know why that would be useful.
So there's a thing to have the bits wrap around, you say?
Yeah.
So that is not. I'm not aware of a C or C++ operator to do that. However, XE6 does have an instruction to do that. And it is very actually common to find hardware with instructions to do that. Partly because this is a very easy thing to implement in hardware and sometimes useful, apparently. But we, in fact, do not. As far as I know, there's not a C or C++ operator that does it. Okay. So we have a shift left operator, which looks exactly the same as our shift right. And just like with the shift right operator, you can also think about it just as a math operator, that it multiplies by a power of 2. And that's all I have for today, so since I'm trying to keep sync with the other lecture, so there's a post-quiz and a pre-quiz. And if you don't have the correct grade on Bob, please tell me.